Very good morning. Let us turn to 1 Samuel chapter 8. All right, 1 Samuel chapter 8, and we're looking at verse 9 to verse 22. Our topic for this morning is the price of worldliness. In other words, what will worldliness cost us? How do we determine the price of something? How do we determine price? I mean, basically, it's a measure of value, right? It is that which a person is willing to pay for something, whether a good or a service, right? So in economic terms, we place a monetary value on a particular thing. And, in our system, there is a currency, right? So that is measured in dollars and cents. And we say, well, this is a price. You go to a shop, it's all listed out, right? These are the prices that you have to pay if you want to buy this particular good. You have people that offer services, and they will have published rates, $50 an hour, $100 an hour, $150 an hour. And so we make a decision. Is this a price that I'm willing to pay? And it's all, well, based on how much you want it, right? You make an assessment. Oh, this thing to me is very cheap. I think it's a very reasonable price, and so I pay the price because I want it. To someone else, they look at the same product and they say, that's no too much. I don't want it as much. I'm not willing to pay as much for that particular good. And that's how we determine value, right? And that stretches from the cheapest thing, right? Something that costs perhaps a few cents or a few dollars, or something as expensive as a house or a car. And these are probably the single largest purchases that you will be making in your life. And so you have to make an assessment, right? Is it worth it to me? Is this a price that I'm willing to pay? But beyond just dollars and cents, I mean, there are other things that we would foot, pay, or, put out in order to attain a certain thing. Because a lot of times it's not just about the money. There is a time. There is an expense, right? The expense of time that is spent, or the energy or other resources that you are willing to put in order to attain whatever it is that you want to attain. And recently, I've heard of this, I don't know, we call it hype or craze, Labubu dolls. Have you heard of it before? I have not heard of it before. Recently, I started to hear about these. This thing, this doll, apparently, that people are now crazy for. And every time it's released, people will queue up, right? They will spend hours waiting. Now it's winter, right? Out there in the cold, camping in front of the shop, waiting for the shops to open, and then they go in and they grab. Why? Because to them, it's worth it. I mean, it's just a little doll. Apparently, on the black, not black market, but in the, what do you call it? In the aftermarket, right? You can buy it online, or people are willing to pay online thousands for some of the rarer one, or the more exclusive one, or the limited edition ones. And that's the price, right? That's the price that they are willing to pay. I mean, to me, I look at that doll and says, you give me a free, I also don't want. What am I going to do with these dolls? It looks silly, right? But to some other people, they are collectors, or they want to sell it, or they find that there is a worth to it, and so they are willing to do that, right? And that's how the world works. Some people find value in certain things and they are willing to pay. Some people find no value in it and they're not willing to pay. That's how we determine price and value. Today we're talking about the price of worldliness. And basically, we're saying, what is it worth to you? Or what are you willing to give so that you can gain the world and the things of the world that you seek after? I mean, the context of the passage before us was the desire for a king. And last Lord's Day, we described how, well, that is the heart of their worldliness, right? That is something that they wanted very much. Why? Because they looked at the nations around them and they had a king. And they said, we want a king like them, like all the nations. We want to be like the world. We want to have all the benefits of having a king, well, seemingly like what the world has. And even though Samuel warned them and he says, no, that is not right. And God also explicitly explained, he says, when you do so, you are rejecting me. Because what you desire is not a king after my design. You are desiring a king like the world. But they did not listen, of course. And so what God then instructed Samuel to do is to, yes, you listen to their voice, yet protest solemnly unto them and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. Basically, explain to them, what is it going to cost you? What is it going to cost? Explain to them, right, the price that you will have to pay in order to have a king. And it's not going to be cheap. Not going to be cheap in the sense of the sort of sacrifices that you have to make as a nation in order to have that king. And so that is what Samuel is going to do here. Really to present to them, right, what the price it is that you're going to pay. And ask them, is this something that you are willing to foot? Is this a bill that you are willing to foot? Right? Is this something that you're willing to give up? Are these things that you're willing to give up in order to get that king? And that is the assessment that all of us will have to make also. When a temptation is presented before you, when you look out into the world and all that the world is doing, know that there is a price to pay. Counting the cost, that's how the Bible describes it, right? Have we counted the cost? Have we sat down and did the sums, so to speak? And ask ourselves, now, is this a worthy sacrifice, so to speak? But not sacrifice in a good sense, but sacrifice in, well, what is it in your life they're willing to give up in order to gain the world, in order to be like the world, in order to have the pleasures of the world, the luxuries of the world, the enjoyments of the world, the sin of the world. What is the price you're willing to pay? And so Samuel told the words of the Lord unto the people that asked of a king. And so he began in verse 11. What is it going to cost you? Well, firstly, he talks about the people dear to them. Their sons and their daughters. Are you willing to sacrifice the people dear to you in order to get a king? That was the first issue, the main idea that he put forth to them. And so he says, this will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. Firstly, he will take your sons, verse 11, and then he will take your daughters, verse 13. Now you're going to notice in the next few verses that he will repeat this phrase over and over again. He will take. Right? He will take your sons. He will take your daughters. Verse 14, he will take your fields. Verse 15, he will take the tenth of your seed. Verse 17, he will take the tenth of your sheep. He will take. That's a price, right? That is what he will demand of you. That is what you will have to be willing to sacrifice in order to have this king. And so the first thing is that he will take all that are dear to you. There will be conscription. Because previously, in the theocracy that they were in, there was no standing army. There was no king to rally behind, right? And so they were all tribes. And as and when, yes, conflicts arose, a judge will come, he will rally the people, they will come, and they will fight. But they were not a standing army. They were not a trained army. They were all farmers, they were all doing their own thing. And then, yes, they will bring their scythes, their pickaxe, their plowshares. You know, these are just their farming equipment. That's how they fought with in the time of Judges. But he says, now, if you really want a king like the other nations, he's going to form an army. And that army is going to require, you know, tradespersons, skilled people to upkeep that army. And so he will appoint for himself his chariots to be his horsemen. So some will have to ride the chariots, some will ride the horsemen, some will run before the chariots. So basically you have all the different wings or the arms of the armed forces, right? You have the army, the foot soldiers, you're going to have the artillery, you're going to have the chariots, the armor, all these different aspects of their military service, you're going to have that. And you're going to have require captains over thousands, captains over 50, set them to do all these things. And so you're going to have a regular army. That's conscription. And they're going to have to leave your home, right? It's not like, you know, Singapore, you know, we have NS, right? But then every weekend you can go home. Every week, some vocations, every day you can go home. No, they're going to have to leave and they're going to stay in Jerusalem. At that point of time, not Jerusalem yet. They're going to have to stay in the capital with the king. They're going to spend weeks and months on end on their training. And they're going to go to war. They're going to fight. They're going to have to die on the battlefield. That's what it's going to cost. You're going to lose your sons. And then some of them will have to be laborers. So some of them will have to join the army. Some of them he will appoint to ear. That means to plow his fields, his ground, to reap his harvest. Some of them are going to have to be laborers in the king's fields because the king is going to have property. The king is going to have lands that are appointed to him. He's going to need workmen to work his grounds, to work his lands. He's going to require tradespersons, carpenters, blacksmiths, so that they can make instruments of war, right? To forge your weapons, your bows and your arrows, your swords, your spears. They're going to have to make the chariots. They're going to have to tend the horses. You're going to have to all these people. It's going to cost. Right? Because a king needs his entourage. He needs the people to serve him. He's going to have servants in his palace. The king's going to be expensive. And these were things which they previously did not have. I mean, in their previous system, basically, you just stay at home. And you do the trade of your father. Whatever business or whatever occupation your father is, you follow after him. He's a carpenter, you become a carpenter. He's a blacksmith, you're a blacksmith, right? And most of them were farmers. Most of them were landowners. And so the expectation is that their sons and their daughters, they will work. Work in the fields as the moment they become old enough to hold a tool. They do all these things. But then now you ask for a king, your son and your daughter is going to have to leave home. And you can't do anything about it. If the king calls, the king calls. You have to obey. Your daughters will not be spared either, right? They will be confectionaries, to be cooks, to be bakers. I mean, there will be things that the daughters will have to do as well. There will be handmaidens to the queen, to the princesses. They will come and they have to work in the kitchens, to be cooks, to be bakers. They will have all these duties and responsibilities. Are you willing to give it up? And we see it did happen. It did happen, for example, during Solomon's time. In Solomon's time, he embarked in that huge building project to build the temple and then to build his palace. And what did he do? I'll just read to you in 1 Kings chapter 5, Solomon, verse 13, Solomon raised a levy out of all Israel, and the levy was 30,000 men. And so there was a forced conscription. Why? Because he needed laborers. He sent them to Lebanon. 10,000 a month by course, a month they were in Lebanon and 2 months at home. And so they sort of have a rotation, right? All of you will have this national service that you're required to do, right? You spend a month in Lebanon, or you go there, you hew down the wood, you bring all these things that you need, right? To chop down the trees, to bring the trees back home so that we have all these raw material to build the palace, to build the house of the Lord. And he had 70,000. So there were these 30,000 to work in Lebanon, but there were others, right? So 70,000 that bear burden, and 80,000, so 80,000 hewers in the mountains. So it was a huge undertaking. And he basically rallied all the people, the men, right, had to do all these hard labor for free, for the king, because the king asks of it. And they have to do that, all right? And besides the chief of Solomon's officers that were over the work, there were 3,300 which ruled over the people that wrought in the work. And the king commanded. The king commanded. They had to do that, right? And so that will be the cost. That will be the cost. To sacrifice your sons and your daughters. Why? Because you want a king. That's the first cost that was to be given. And I mean, you look at this cost and you think, oh, that's all right. I mean, that's reasonable, right? I mean, to have a king, we understand that he requires people. He requires people to go and to do all these things. But, when you think about the whole idea of worldliness, right? Worldliness is basically that which is in opposition to God and what God does not want us to have. And then we put things towards that. That thought taken to the extreme, some of the kings did not just take your sons and your daughters to work for them. He took their sons and their daughters and killed them. And you see that in some of the wicked kings, the most wicked kings, what do they do? Ahaz, Manasseh, for example. You see that in 2 Chronicles. I just read passages to you in chapter 28. This was Ahaz, one of the most wicked kings to have reigned over Judah. He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. He made molten images for Baalim. Moreover, he burnt incense in the valley of the sons of Hinnom. He burnt his children in the fire after the abominations of the heathen whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. Manasseh did the same thing a few generations later. Chapter 33, verse 6, he caused his children to pass through the fire in the valley of the sons of Hinnom. Children sacrifice. Child sacrifice. That is very extreme, right? That's terrible. But you see, that is the extent of what worldliness will cost, in which you worship that which God hates. You chase after the lusts of the world, the pleasures of the world, the desires of the world. And taken to the extreme end, it is that in pursuit of idolatry, which is worldliness, worldliness is idolatry, in pursuit of all these things, you are willing to give up even that which you think to be the most dear to you. That is the cost. You say, no, I'm never going to go near that. That's not at all what I'm going to do. But think again. When we seek after the pleasures of this world, when we seek after worldliness, sometimes the damage that is done, the collateral, you may say, is that we are actually sacrificing our children. In what way, you ask? You see, for them, it was the desire for a king, right? And so that desire blinded them such that when Samuel said, "Now you're going to have to lose your sons and daughters at a young age, they're going to have to work for the king," they'll say, "Fine, fine, take my children and go. Take my children and go because I want the king so much." In many ways, we do that as well. Because of our career, for many of us, that's the idol, right? That's the worldliness that we seek after. Because of my ambition and my career, children, they are an annoyance. They are a hindrance to me, right? It is such a responsibility that I was not prepared to have. And now I have them. One, two, three, four children. They take up so much of my time. I don't want them around. And what do? I palm them off, send them to childcare, send them to all these other places where other people are taking care of them. We place them in front of screens and all sorts of entertainment. We try to find all these other activities for them to do so that they will not be a hindrance to me. Why? Because I want to work. I want to earn more. I want my wife to work. We need both that income because we need to buy the things that we want to buy, because we want to have the careers that we are not willing to give up. And so these are our gods, so to speak. And in the process of that, we sacrifice our children. And we think that's fine. No big deal. Not a problem. Even the world, to an extent, understands this issue. Maybe not so much today because they are so willing. Right, to do that, to have minimal interaction with their children because, well, children are just a hindrance in my life. I meet them for 1, 2 hours a day, that's plenty. There's this song, I think it's from the 70s. Some of you may be familiar with it. It's a secular song, right? I came across when I was introduced to this, I think in literature in school, right, when I was in school. It's called Cats in the Cradle.
And it's from the perspective of a father. And he writes this song, he writes the words of this song. He says, "My child arrived just the other day. He came to the world in the usual way. There were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away. And was talking before I knew it. And as he grew, he said, 'I'm going to be like you, Dad. And, you know, I'm going to be like you.'" And so it goes on to narrate sort of the things in life that started to happen. "My son turned 10 the other day. He said, 'Thanks for the ball, Dad. Come on, Dad, let's play. Can you teach me to throw?' I said, 'Not today. I've got a lot to do.' He said, 'That's okay.' And he walked away, but his smile never dimmed. He says, 'I'm going to be like you. Yeah, I'm going to be like you.'" And then he fast forwards a number of years. He says, "He came home from college just the other day. So much like a man, I just had to say, 'Son, I'm proud of you. Can you sit for a while?' He shook his head and then said with a smile, 'What I really like, Dad, is to borrow the car keys. I'll see you later. Can I have them, please?'" And then finally, this last stanza, he says, "I've long since retired. My son's moved away. I've called him up just the other day. He said, 'I'd like to see you.' I said, 'I'd like to see you if you don't mind.' He said, 'I'd love to, Dad, but if I can find the time. You see, my job's a hassle. The kids got a flu, but it's been nice talking to you, Dad. It's been nice talking to you.' And as I hung up the phone, it occurred to me, he had grown up just like me. My boy was just like me." I think we see the story here, isn't it? A man who was busy. He's busy. He had no time for the son. And so he sacrificed his son on the altar of jobs, of work, of ambition, of career. And before he knew it, his son was grown. And now he had the time. He wanted to spend time with the children. The son says, "Oh, I'm busy now." The son had become just like him. And I mean, this is from a secular perspective, right? It's just about time spent. But we know our duty as a parent, our duty as fathers and mothers are far more than that. It's not just about quality time or wanting to spend time with them or seeing them through the milestones that they hit. It is about that spiritual responsibility that we have, isn't it? It's about that duty that we have in the lives of our children, and at the earliest age possible, we exert the maximum amount of influence that we can over their lives. Spend time with them, show forth Christ to them, instruct them, teach them in the way of the Lord. But we neglect that. We find it bothersome. We find it a chore. And we much rather pursue after the things of the world, right? Whether it is our jobs, our careers, or sometimes even our hobbies, right? Yeah, we work the whole day, we come back. But instead of, well, fulfilling our responsibilities, what do? We pursue that which we want to pursue, our love for the worldliness of this world. Whatever it is, right? Watching your shows or spending time on your phone or going out to play whatever sports or whatever it is, right? And again, well, these are the things that we seek after over and above the responsibilities that we have. And what are we doing? We are placing, as it were, our children on the altar. And like the people, it says, "Fine, fine, take my children, take my sons and my daughters. We want a king more than we care about our sons and our daughters." Or it could be the other way around. I mean, one is neglect, right? One is neglect, where we neglect our children for the world. Another way in which we sacrifice our children for the world is that when we push them into the world, when we have an ambition for them that is not spiritual but worldly, where what we are concerned about is their future in the world. And so at the earliest age possible, we say, "Oh, we need to do coaching." I think that's what they call it here, right? Singapore, we call it tuition. Here it's coaching, right? Send them for all the extra classes to prepare them, right? Because the world is competitive, right? And I want them to get into the best courses, the best schools, the universities, the careers, the jobs. And so I've heard over here, as young as preschool, they go for math class, science, language, everything. And all their days are filled. And you say, I care about my children. I'm a stay-home mom. But what do? You spend all your time ferrying them. This class, that class, this activity, that activity, because you want to build up their resume from the youngest age, get them into the best schools. Again, what are we doing? We are pushing them out into the world. We are pushing them, raising them to become worldly, isn't it? Because that becomes your priority and your emphasis. Every day, instead of sharing with them spiritual things, you are pushing this ideology in their head that you must work hard, you must strive hard to be successful in the world. That is the highest and the greatest aim. And you show that in the emphasis that you have in their lives also. They can pick up these things, right? What upsets you more? That they didn't do their work and they're not disciplined, I mean, they're not showing the good results? Or their spiritual lives? What is it? What delights you more? When they show spiritual growth and maturity, or the good grades that come in? Yes. Yes, got into whatever school, this course, what is it that they have, OC classes and selective schools and the university of choice. What is it that delights you more? And they pick up on that, isn't it? You see, okay, if I work hard, daddy and mommy will be very happy with me. If I get all the good grades and I get into the good schools, yeah, that's what daddy and mommy is looking for. And, you know, they want to do right. They want to do well. But because you push them in that direction, that becomes who they are. Will you not be surprised? When they grow up, they become independent. And then they just turn away from the church. And they say, well, that was not at all what I grew up realizing was important. You told me that the world is important. You told me that the most important thing is to do well in school so that you can get a good career. And now I've got the career, I'd better do well. The career is demanding, is taxing, is requiring a lot out of me. And I'm doing well, am I not? I'm doing that which you told me to do. I'm focusing hard on my career. And they turn their way from the Lord. And that's how we sacrifice them. We sacrifice them to the world because of our heart of worldliness. Because we say the world is so important, I'm willing to sacrifice them. That's a first. Right, we sacrifice our sons and our daughters, pushing them out into the world either through neglect or through our ambition for them. And then the next thing he goes on to explain in verse 14 to verse 17 is their possessions, right? Firstly, is the people dear to them? And then he says, you will have to sacrifice your possessions. He will take your fields and your vineyards and your oliveyards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. And he will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to the officers and to his servants. And so basically, you see, the king is going to have to own land, right? I mean, the king has to be rich. He has to be the focal point of the nation, and he can't be poor. He has to have a palace, and you have to have palace grounds. You have to food. He needs food to upkeep all the thousands of people that were going to have to come under his servitude. And he needed land for that. And so he's going to acquire from who? From you, from your people. And he's going to have a tax, right? He's going to have to pay to build the palace, to upkeep the palace, to maintain his own lavish lifestyle, because that is the expectation, right? The king has to have the highest honor in all the land. And so you need to pay for that. And so for the first time, they're going to have to start paying taxes. And so Samuel said, well, a tenth of all your seed of your vineyard, and you have to pay. He has to pay his officers. He has to pay his servants. He will take your manservants and your maidservants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to work. Again, he's going to have to take all these things. A tenth of your sheep, ye shall be his servants. Basically, it's going to be expensive. You're going to have to be prepared to pay for the king. And a simple point that we have to make here then is that it's good. I mean, worldliness is expensive. To upkeep a worldly life is expensive. Because the focus of the king for them, I mean, for a large part of it, is actually material. Right? It was their way to showcase to the other nations that we have arrived. We're not just a band of tribes, right, that have scavenged this land for ourselves and we're just trying to make ends meet. No, we are a powerful and a successful nation. And how do we present that? We have a king. And our king is rich, right? We can't have our king walking around in rags. No, he has to have that resplendent gown. He has to have an entourage everywhere he goes, right? He has to travel in the best chariots, in the best carriages. He is going to have a palace with all the best that money can buy. It is going to cost because they need to show to the world around them that they are a great and glorious nation. It's going to have to cost money. Are you willing to pay for that? And again, the answer was yes. Yes. Now, it seems to be a little bit of a circular thing, right? We talk about worldliness and oftentimes it's equated to the love of money. But actually, the reason why there is a love of money is not so much of the money itself, but really what money can buy, right? That's worldliness for a large part of it, right? We want to seek after the things of the world, and, well, currency is just a means to that end. And so basically what is worldliness is really the desire for more things, the more things of this world. Again, whether it's the goods or services that this world can offer. And so when we seek after worldliness, it's really, you know, in a way you can call it a sacrifice of our wealth, but it's also the pursuit of that wealth, right? Because when the king has to do these things, what does that entail? It means you're going to have to work harder, right, to make up for that loss of your vineyards, of your olive yards, of the best of it, right? You have to give it to the king. And so now you have to pay that tax on top of your tithe, remember? I mean, they had that basic tithe, the offering that they will bring to the temples to present to the Lord. Now, on top of that, they're going to have to pay an additional tithe, so to speak, a tenth to the king. Okay, so there's going to be an additional expense that they're going to have to factor in. And what does that mean? They're going to have to work harder. They're going to spend more time on the fields. They're going to have to spend more time in the marketplace. I mean, their lives are going to have to get busier for the king's sake. Is that not a picture of worldliness as well? When people seek after the things of this world, that's what motivates them to work harder, to seek after that promotion, to be willing to put in those extra hours. Why? Because that is the commitment that they have made to the world. I need, or I feel like I need, whatever it is that is on our shopping list. Whether we're talking about the huge, large purchases of a new home, a new car, a larger house, a larger car. Or whether it's expensive hobbies that we want to upkeep. Some of these hobbies are ridiculously expensive. And how do I know? Sad to say, I have fallen. Many of these things throughout my life, different things that I come to desire and take interest in. And before I know it, I'm browsing, I'm scrolling, I'm coveting. I want that. Wow, the next model, the better one, the next model after that, oh, it'll be even better. Before you know it, you're chained to these things because of your lust for the things of this world. The more, the better, the bigger, the nicer. The next greatest thing. What is the thing that you're craving for? I mean, whatever it is, right? Whether it's that silly-looking doll, right? Whether it's a brand new car, or whether, you know, it is, you know, that gadget, that device, that luxury item, that experience. What are these things that which we think are needs, but in actual fact, they are wants. And we convince ourselves that these are all necessities of life. And then we lament as, oh, you know, I've been so busy, I've been working there so hard. But what actually are we doing? We are basically living beyond our means. And for that, we feel that we have to work harder. We have to get that promotion. We have to make sure that both husband and wife work full time. Because we can't make ends meet. Really? Is that the real problem? Now, yes, granted, we understand. right? Inflation is a thing. In our generation and the young people of today, they have it very, very hard. And it's almost, you know, people say, oh, yeah, it's almost impossible not to have, you know, a dual income family in order to, you know, pay off that mortgage. But are we counting the cost that worldliness is costing us, that desire for more? Is it really a need or is it more a want? Are we driving ourselves to the ground, sacrificing our possessions? And really, in actual fact, what we're sacrificing is our life. Time that could better be spent, yeah, with the children, raising up our homes, our families, spending time in the Lord, serving the Lord, spending time witnessing for the Lord. Our energy, our time, it is all sacrificed to the altar of worldliness. Why? Because we are craving after more and more. And we think that that is what will fulfill us. Just as what Israel at that point of time thought. If once we have a king, yes, that is what we need. That is what we need. They convinced themselves that that was the thing that will help them to become that successful and that powerful nation. And yeah, I mean, granted, sometimes, yeah, these concerns are very pragmatic. And pragmatic in a sense where it seemed to have originally stemmed from what was a legitimate concern. Samuel, your sons are not good, right? They are not going to be good leaders. And so instead of that, put a king in his place. Because, yeah, if we have a king, maybe things will be better for us as a nation, right? It's not wrong to work. Of course, we all have to work. We all need to work. And that's a biblical responsibility. To provide for our homes, it is a biblical responsibility. In fact, the Bible goes so far as to say that if you don't do that, you are worse than an infidel, right? It is your responsibility. But where are you able to discern where to draw the line? When it is me fulfilling my biblical responsibility or me pursuing worldliness, me sacrificing my life in pursuit of the things of this world. So what is money to you? What are possessions to you? For the believer, it simply has to be just a means to an end, a sustenance, right? To provide for my family, and that should be enough. Because to go beyond that, it is then the lustful pursuit of more, more, thinking that that is what will bring me enjoyment, fulfillment, and fun in this life. And sometimes we even garb it as, well, my responsibility, right, as a husband, as a father, and I want to provide for my, I want to give them the best possible upbringing. And you fill their lives with luxuries and material things, but you don't give them that which is most important. You fail to give them Christ. You fail to bring them up in the fear and the knowledge of the Lord. We shirk that responsibility. And what happens? We don't safeguard their spiritual lives. We just let them out into the world. Seek whatever entertainment you want. That's the babysitter, right? The tablet, the TV. Whatever they scroll, whatever they press, up to them. You just give them that open account. Scroll through Netflix, scroll through YouTube, imbibe all the entertainments of the world. That's fine. As long as you are out of my business, I need to focus on my work, right? And you say, yeah, I'm at home, I'm taking care of them. Husband and wife, yeah, we work from home now, it's fine. We can both have that job and career. Yeah, I'm there. Are we really there? Because sacrificing, you know, on this altar of possessions, of desiring for more things, some things in our life have to give, and most of the time, the collateral damage, so to speak, is our children. They are neglected. Is that the price that we're willing to pay? And so that was the case that Samuel presented to them. It was clear from his arguments that it will not be an arrangement that will be advantageous to them. I mean, you know, to put it bluntly, the king will be a parasite, a leech from their resources. He will take and take and take and not give much in return at all. That was what Samuel was saying, right? At least a king in the way of the world, a king who multiplies silver and gold, a king who has, right, horses and chariots, a king who is there just as a political leader, not a spiritual leader. Now, in time to come, yes, God will raise up a king after his own heart. It's not to say that God was against the idea of having a king, but if their desire was a king like all the nations, well, this is what it's going to be. Is that the price that you're willing to pay? Because sadly for them, when they said yes to all these things, and Samuel presented this case to them, basically what they're saying is that they were willing to sacrifice their walk with the Lord. And that's the, you can say, the highest sacrifice, isn't it? Of course, not in a good sense. But it is a costly sacrifice. Because in verse 18, this is what he told them. He says, "You shall cry out in that day because of your king, which you have chosen you. And the Lord will not hear you in that day." I mean, it's very direct to tell them that, you see, you will have to pay the price. And one day you may regret that. There will come a point of time that you say, "I want out. Oh, it was wrong for me to clamor after a king." Maybe they feel that the king is not all they'd expected. They might regret that decision. Or in time to come, there will be wicked, corrupt kings, right? There will be kings that are indulgent, that are self-seeking kings. They are not effective or good leaders at all. And then they will cry out unto the Lord, but the Lord will not hear. He will say, "Serves you right." It'd be too late. But they didn't care. Even when Samuel warned them, right, "The Lord will not hear you." Basically to say that this desire and, you know, pursuing this to the very end is going to affect and hamper your walk with the Lord. Your prayers will not be heard. But what was their response? Nevertheless, the people refused to obey. Basically, we don't care. We don't care. You tell me that one day, because of this decision, God will not hear my prayers. Sure, why not? Fine. That is a price that they were willing to pay. Is that a price that you are willing to pay? To think that the pursuit of worldliness, right, desiring what the world wants, being like the world, you know, and people warn you, that if you go down this line, your walk with the Lord is going to be affected. And then you shrug and you say, "Well, that's my choice." Have you ever talked to people like that? Or be in that situation yourself? When someone warns you and tells you, "Stop, please." No, that is not what a believer should be doing. This is not how we should be prioritizing our time, our efforts. But you don't care. Because you want the world, and you want the world, what the world can offer you. You are pursuing after that sin. What happens? We become hard-hearted. And that is what the people were at this point of time. They were blinded by their worldly desire. They just wanted it no matter what. You know, it's not that as a nation they were doing badly. They were not. Right? Samuel, as we have seen in the previous chapter, you know, his time with them as a judge was effective. They had peace. They had victory over the Philistines. You know, things were okay. It's not like, you know, they were in terribly miserable situation and then they thought, okay, the king is a solution. No, they were fine. God was taking care of them. But they wanted more. And, you know, later on, it will be revealed in chapter 12 when Samuel rebukes them one final time for this whole request of a king. You know, he will give us this an additional little detail, right, to show us how terrible this desire for them really was. If you look across to chapter 12, right, look across to chapter 12, and verse 12 says, "And when ye saw that Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon, came against you, ye said unto me, Nay, but a king shall reign over us when God was your king." You see, what was the problem there? You see, Samuel identified the object of their desire. It was Nahash, the king of the Amorites, right? They saw that, you see, this other nation is doing so well. They have a king like Nahash, and he's so attractive. We want a king like him. And so it was when they saw that there was this king, and yes, he was raising his army and coming against them, they were afraid. But then instead of saying, pray for us and help, may the Lord help us, their solution was, we need one like that, right? They got one, we need one. But who was Nahash? What was Nahash like? And we'll see this, right? We'll see this in time to come. In chapter 11, right, there was this whole incident where the king of the Amorites came against them. And what we see is that he was a terribly wicked king. He was a very cruel king, right? And he gave that message. And we'll come and see that later on, right? But he was not at all a good example. He was not at all someone that they should have lusted after, so to speak, to desire after a king like these pagan kings. Because you know what he did? When he came against them, he threatened to thrust out their right eyes, to mutilate every single one of them, unless they surrender. That was the cruelty of Nahash, king of the Amorites. And when they heard that threat, and instead of being disgusted by such immorality, such wickedness, such cruelty, they said, we want a king just like him. We want a king that can go around and make threats to other nations and exert our power and our influence. We want to be like him. That was their worldliness. And because of that, they were so set in their ways. Their hearts were hardened. And so no matter what Samuel said and pleaded and argued with them, they said, nevertheless, they will not hear. They refused to obey. Stubborn and fixed in their ways. And sadly, that is often the state of a person whose heart is out there in the world. And nothing you say will get through. You warn them, you show them all the Bible verses. You exhort them from Scripture. You tell them, you coax them, you warn them. You say, please, please reconsider. But they don't listen. Whether it's a young person trying to court the unbeliever, boyfriend or girlfriend, and say, oh, but she's so attractive. Oh, he makes me so happy. Oh, you know, he's not like other guys. She's not like the other girls. Yeah, yeah, she doesn't go to church, but she's a good girl. I know her. And they refuse to listen. The spouse that is heading towards that affair, spending time with a person, a man or woman that is not his wife, not his husband, and you warn that person, stop it before it gets too late. They refuse to listen. They're already taking up in an affair. And he says, stop it, come back to your wife, come back to your wife, break out of that relationship. They refuse to listen. They say, you don't understand what sort of person my wife is, what sort of person my husband is. This woman, this man makes me feel so much better. You tell them, stop it. This is ruining your life, ruining your family, ruining your children. They don't listen. Why? Because they want what the world can offer. And he said, everyone else does it. It's so common. What's the problem? What's the big deal? That person that's considering their promotion, knowing full well that this is going to take a heavy toll on his life. He's going to have to spend long hours, more stress. Weekends will get burned. Evenings will get burned. But he says, wow, you know, but the package, the pay package is so attractive. The boss has promised me, right? He's going to make me partner. He's going to triple my salary. Oh, I'm going to get all these benefits. It's wonderful. It's worth it. And they did do that. They said, boss, I want you, the boss says, I want you to relocate. Sure, fine, where? Tell me, I'll go. Children, family, doesn't matter. I'll go. I'll go because of the opportunity. Oh, and he said, no, it's not the money, you know, it's the experience, right? It's going to be so wonderful. I'm going to have all these things that I'm going to learn. Is it worth it? What is the price that you're willing to pay? It doesn't matter that your walk with the Lord, your relationship with Him will get affected, damaged, destroyed. No, they're just overwhelmed, filled with their lust, their desire. the temptation they want to give into, the love for world, with worldliness, and they're blinded, like the people here. And we really have to ask ourselves, isn't it? As the Lord Jesus Christ told his disciples, what profit, what gain, what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? That is a question that we have to ask ourselves as well as we think about the price of worldliness. Every day we're going to have to make these decisions. How are we going to orientate our lives? What is the focus and the priorities that we have? What is important to us? And what is the price that we are willing to pay? You see, if the world is attractive to you, the sin and the temptations and all that the world has to offer, if that is appealing to you, yeah, then you are willing to pay, right? You're willing to take whatever you're doing to do whatever it takes to gain the world. And that's what people are willing to pay. And that's what many believers through the ages, sadly, have fallen into that snare, that trap. The cares of the world, the desires of riches. And then they have fallen. And their lives have been snuffed out. Is that the end that we are heading towards as well? Are we looking to the world and it says, wow, how nice. How I wish I could have more of the world. And then what shall it profit, Jesus asks. And so you finally get there. You finally get there. You make your millions. You have everything that your heart could desire. Whatever it is that you are after. The career, the women, their lives of luxury, all the fun, the entertainments that the world can offer, what shall it profit if you shall gain all these things, but in the process, you lose your soul, you lose your family, you lose your children's souls? Is it worth it? Are you willing to pay that price? Solomon had it all, isn't it? He said, whatsoever my heart desired, I kept not from them. But then he looked back with regret and bitterness. He says, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. It was all vexation of spirit. And he had to go through that miserable period where he says, I hated life. I hated my labor. I hated all these things. The lifetime of luxury that he spent building up. He had everything that the world could desire. But then he realized, it was all empty. Learn from him before we get to that point. Before we one day look back in regret and realize that our whole life has passed us by and our life really amounted to nothing. Yeah, we have all those things that the world has. We've built that portfolio, multiple properties. Yeah, you're doing well in the eyes of the world. But how about in the eyes of the Lord? Let's turn to the Lord in prayer. Our gracious, loving Heavenly Father, we thank Thee for Thy word, this warning that comes before us. It's how the people of Israel clamored and desired for the things of this world, and we learn from their mistakes. Learn to know what truly is precious and important in this life that Thou hast given to us. And Lord, we pray that Thou take away this covetous heart, the desires for the things of this world from our lives, and fill us with a desire and a yearning for things above. Pray that help us not to set our affection on all these things, but always only on eternal things. May you bless us in Jesus' most blessed name we pray. Amen.